the person from whom everything comes. And the text is spoken by Lord Brahma. He's the original creator of this universe, the firstborn living being, and who's exceptionally otherworldly intelligent. But more than intelligent, he becomes pure in devotion. We heard a little bit the means by which he became pure. He became pure primarily by chanting of two mantras, according to Sri Brahma Samhita. One of those mantras he heard from before there was anything. There was just darkness in all directions before creation began. No sun, no moon, no cell phone, nobody to go and talk to, no place to go even if that was vacant. There was nothing but darkness in all directions, and his mantra. So he really took shelter of his mantra, and he became spiritually elevated, and sufficiently that Krishna initiated him in another mantra, in a very interesting way how that mantra was given. It was given by Krishna's flute. And when that sound of Krishna's flute entered the ears of Lord Brahma, from his mouth came another mantra, Kama Gayatri Mantra. And through this Kama Gayatri Mantra, Brahma became well acquainted with the ocean of truth. Truth, again, with the capital T. That is, the absolute reality of Krishna. So we discussed already Krishna's abode, what Brahma realized, the message through sound vibration that he provides about Krishna's abode, Goloka, what it's like there. It's like it's a travel brochure. You should want to go there because it's really nice. Here's how nice it is. And then he describes the truths about Krishna's form and then Krishna's pastimes, in essence. And then those messages are then expanded in later texts. So where we ended was following those three texts. That's Krishna's abode, Krishna's form, and Krishna's pastimes. There's a series of four verses that discuss Lord Brahma anticipates that there are worldly people who have worldly conceptions, and when they hear of other worldly or beyond this realm, transcendental features of Krishna, they have doubts. No, it can't. How can it be like that? How can Krishna do like that? And so forth. So to help, this is like the technology end. How is it that, what are the aspects of Krishna that, if you understand, then you can easily respond, oh, that's how Krishna does what he does. That's how he is the way he is. Now I understand. So with that in mind, we discussed the absolute nature of Krishna's form, and therefore, because of the absolute nature of Krishna's form, there is no limitation like there is with material form. There's limitation. I can sit in the chair, but I can't eat it for lunch. There's the function of each thing is limited. And with material form, like bodies, there's unwholesomeness, like bodies make mistakes, or bodies get old and diseased, and Krishna doesn't make mistakes. He's a perfect being, because that's different than material. There's no limitation to him. And on that basis, one limb of Krishna can do anything any other limb can do, because the limb of Krishna is Krishna. There's no parts of him, and you put the parts together, you get the whole. Each part is the whole. It's a necessary conception to then understand Krishna's pastimes. Say in reverse. If we don't understand the transcendental nature of Krishna's form, we will not understand the transcendental nature of Krishna's pastimes. That's the coming attractions. It's going to describe in more detail the pastimes of Krishna. So, now let us chant together. You can see the verse on the screen? Okay. And let's hope technology works again. The sound of this mantra. You ready or should I wait? That means I should wait. Is that the signal? Should I go ahead? Okay, and now we're going to hopefully read the translation. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas but obtainable by pure unalloyed devotion of the soul, who is without a second, who is not subject to decay, who is without beginning, whose form is endless, who is the beginning and the eternal Purusha, yet he is a person possessing the beauty of blooming youth. So you've seen just as a review point, I'm going to review these four verses that are a group, okay? So, the group of four is to help us understand how Govinda can be like this, how he can do as he does, and that therefore his existence, his form, and his abode, and his leelas, they're not imagination, and they're not unwholesome. That's the theme of these four. And in the verse that we discussed this morning, that's text 32, we found the same Sanskrit phrase that's there in the first verse. Ananda Chinmaya Sad Ujvala Vigraha. That's his form. Vigraha means form. The form of Govinda is full of dazzling splendor. That's this Ujvala. And is of the absolute nature, Sachit Ananda. Whoops. And as a result, since this form is absolute, each limb is interchangeable with another limb. With his eyes, he can boil an ocean. With his eyes, he can eat. With his ears, he can eat. With his eyes, he can impregnate. And so forth. With his flute, he can call cows. And he can send forth mantras. Not just, you know, do-do-do-do-do. He can... His body is absolute, and on that basis, he can do what he does. And it's not imaginative or unwholesome. And these points are going to be important later on. So it's worth repeating them. And so this verse is his form, vigraha, once again, is Navayovana. Navayovana means eternally youthful. Eternally youthful. It's like we gave the example. Krishna appeared to be 16 throughout his whole life. He never got old and gray and wrinkled and, you know, slow walking and hunched over. And never. Because his body is fully spiritual. Just like when he appeared in the prison house of Kamsa, he was not like an ordinary child appears when a child is born. He was in a full adult stature with garland and ornaments and crown and the symbols of Vishnu. It's not how children normally appear when they're first born. And then, within moments, he assumed a childlike form. Very, very flexible in his appearances. But although he's the oldest, he's eternally youthful. And similarly, apparently contradictory attributes, Bhaktisiddhanta calls it irreconcilable. Reconcile? Do you know what that word means, reconcile? Well, people that do accounting, they know what reconcile is. You have some books, some accounting, and this number has to match that number. And if they don't, you have to reconcile. You have to make them out so that this equals that. They show the same conclusion. So it's irreconcilable attributes. On the one hand, he's eternally youthful. On the other hand, he's the oldest. So how do you reconcile? They're irreconcilable attributes. So how are those apparently irreconcilable attributes of Govinda be understood? And the verse begins by stating, you can't just by academic power. You can't get a bunch of PhDs in a number of subjects and then understand Krishna. He's not to be understood that way. Even if the PhDs are in different parts of the Vedic texts. You get a PhD in Ayurveda, in the science of medicine. You get a PhD in Jyotirveda, in the science of astronomy. You get a PhD in how to perform yajnas. You get a PhD in, you know, and you're still not going to understand Krishna. Because that's not how he's understood, but he's understood alone by the Vedas, that portion of the Vedas that is joined or imbued with the chit potency, the cognitive potency, you know, the sat chit, the chit potency, or samvit is another of the Sanskrit terms, means the same thing. The spiritual potency of Krishna of cognizance, if Krishna gives you that, and the ladini shakti, or the essence of ecstatic energy, in Bhaktisiddhanta's language. There is a portion of the Vedas that are invested, especially, not all the Vedas, but some of the Vedas have that special potency, and those that do, when you come in contact with those, they awaken bhakti, and as they awaken bhakti combined with these understandings, then you can understand Krishna. Not by empiric wisdom. That's this. So, it's this the second of these four verses that we're discussing this evening. Then tomorrow morning, two more. Krishna's vigraha, or his form, his identity, cannot be approached by a perfect yogi or a perfect jnani. Jnani means one who, through empiric study of the scripture, tries to understand what's what. The truths of Krishna are unapproachable that way. And then finally, again, there's seemingly contradictory features of Krishna, that it's specifically his potency and the possessor of the potency, Shakti and Shaktiman, the potency and the possessor of the potency. Although they're different, they're non-different from him. Although they're non-different from him, they're different from him, either way you like to say it. So this difference and non-difference theology, which was a core theology of Lord Chaitanya, it became, by the way, a little history is, he didn't use that phrase. Jiva Goswami started using that phrase. And then it became the phrase by which Lord Chaitanya's teachings were known. And the verse, one of the verses we'll be discussing tomorrow morning, enshrines the scriptural basis for that. And there's many others, but it's at least within Brahma Samhita. There's another one towards the end also that does the same. Okay, so now we're ready for these features described in verse 33, the second of the four, group of four. In verse 33, there's mention of apparent contradictory features within Krishna. And this is taken directly from the purport. If you have a book, it's in your book. But here it is on the screen, so you can look in your book and at the screen at the same time if you are like this camera that looks over here and shows over here. Okay. So, Advaita means non-dual. Bhaktisiddhanta's language, indivisible truth, who is knowledge absolute. That's very tight. Indivisible truth, who is knowledge absolute. Who is not, it's not a what, it's a personal pronoun. Who, not what. So, Krishna is absolute. His form is absolute. What is that? Indivisible truth and knowledge absolute, that's him. So, here's an apparent contradiction. It makes it look divided rather than undivided. That is, there are features of Krishna which are his Brahman feature, that's the effulgence, the jyoti, that emanates from Krishna's planet and from Krishna's body and everything within Krishna's planet. Some places it says the toenails of Krishna. Sometimes it says the boundary walls of Vaikuntha. But everything of the spiritual realm is effulgent. And that's Brahman. That's a feature of Krishna. There's also Bhaktisiddhanta's particular language, God immanent or Paramatma feature, emanates from him as his constituent. At the same time, he's one. So those of you, let me ask for a volunteer. This explanation given by Bhaktisiddhanta is a more or less paraphrase of a very important verse in Srimad Bhagavatam. Who knows what that verse in Srimad Bhagavatam is? I see one hand. I see two hands. I see two and a half. I see three. You had your hand up first. I'll say it again. Just like the first evening we discussed Paribhasha Sutra, some of you were with us, so you remember that. There is another category that this verse represents. It's not, I don't know that there's a term for it, which I've forgotten, but it's an essence verse that helps us understand the message of the whole work, the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, just like this one that's on the screen, the Advaita feature. Everything of Krishna's abode is non-dual. So what does that mean? Well, it means here is a place of duality. Here, like Bhagavad Gita teaches, there is duality. There is heat and cold. There's pleasure and pain. There's honor and dishonor. And, you know, anything you can think of, it has its opposite. There's light and there's dark. There's day and there's night. There's up and there's down. This is a place of duality. So, the spiritual realm is a place of non-duality. It's a place of absolutes. So, some people think, the scholars or empiricists think, okay, since there's variety here, there must be no variety in the spiritual world. Since there's personality here, this is called definition by negation. Since there's personality here, the absolute must have no personality. Since there's form here, the absolute must have no form. I rest my case. And the Srimad Bhagavatam says, no. In the spiritual world, there's variety. But it's all absolute variety. And those others say, no. We say, yes. There's these differences in categories and then subcategories of those categories. But there's homogeneous oneness. There is this condition of sat, or like we discussed in the morning session, substantiality, eternal existence, the all-pervasive feature of the Supreme. There's also a localized feature of the Supreme, who manifests in this realm, Paramatma feature, God immanent. And there's also the personal feature of Krishna upon which all of this rests. And they're all of the same absolute nature. There's diversity in the realm of absolutes. There's plurality in the realm of absolutes. There's plurality without duality. How's that sound? Advaita. Seeming contradiction. Then Achyuta. Achyuta means infallible. So living entities, us, we're called Chyuta because we can fall. But Krishna is Achyuta. He's infallible. He will never fall. He has never, even when he comes here, he's not fallen. He's not like one of us. Here's how Bhaktisiddhanta treats this. Though myriads of avatars emanate from him as subjective portions, and millions of jivas as separated spiritual particles, still he remains intact as the undivided whole of fullest perfection. He doesn't become fallen because he emanates so many things. Equal expansions of him, so many living entities. He's infallible. He's 1 - 1 = 1. Now that's not good math. But the one emanates so many complete expansions of himself, and he's still one. He's not reduced at all. It's a contradiction. By material standards, it's a contradiction. It's a very simple example Prabhupada gives. Supposing you have a piece of paper, and you tear the piece of paper into little pieces, and like a child, you just throw it out in the room. So now you have so many little pieces of paper, and you don't have the original piece of paper anymore. It's spread out throughout the room. But Krishna is such a piece of paper. He's such an entity that although he expands into little pieces and to equal pieces, unlimited numbers of them, he's still one, undivided. That gets a big wow. Wow. You know, think of something that's so big. So big. And you take away something from that, something that's so big and it's still just as big. There isn't something like that. You can't think of something like that. It's inconceivable. Materially. But for Krishna, no problem. It's not even a big wow. It's just his nature. He's a chuta. He's infallible. Oops, I'm looking at my screen. Then anadi is another one. Anadi. Anadi means without beginning. Adi is beginning. And the prefix a in front is without beginning. So, though he indulges, interesting language of Bhakti Siddhanta, though he indulges in exhibiting the pastimes of births, etc., still he is without a beginning. Krishna has no beginning, but he takes birth. He is an adi, but he has a beginning, at least apparently. He who has no beginning has a beginning. Well, that's a contradiction. Seemingly. And the explanation of how he does that is, it's a pastime. So how do we understand the pastime of Krishna's birth? It's a pastime. And the way he does the pastime makes it clear it's a pastime. How he makes his appearance. Then, anantarupam. We're just going through the terms within the first two lines of the verse. Anantarupam. Ananta means unlimited and rupa means form. He has unlimited forms. That's one way. Here's what Bhaktisiddhanta writes. Though he disappears after the pastimes of his appearance, still he is eternal. Or anantarupam, is his form is without end. Anantarupam, his form is without end. Although his form is without end, he disappears. As if there's an end. But there's no end. Adya, though without origin, yet he is with an origin in his pastimes of appearance. And Purana Purusham means, Purana means the oldest or old, and Purusha means person. He's the oldest person, yet he's eternally youthful. It's a contradiction. You can't. You can be one, or you can be the other, but how can you be one and the other at the same time? Krishna can. Although eternal in existence, he is still a person in the full bloom of youth. And the summary message, Bhaktisiddhanta writes in your Brahmasamhita book, The sum and substance of it is, so this is text 33, although he possesses diverse and apparently mutually contradictory, qualities, still they are in universal harmonious concordance by dint of, in bold letters, his unthinkable potency. Again, Bhaktisiddhanta's language, unthinkable. Well, we're thinking about it, aren't we? So it is thinkable. But we can't understand it just by thinking about it. That's the unthinkable part. It's beyond the mind's capacity to conceive of. So how are you going to understand that which is beyond the mind's capacity to conceive of? Well, it's in the first part of the verse, and that it's possible by devotion, by the intelligence that Krishna gives to his devotee. Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upiyanti te. From Bhagavad Gita. So now here, let's take a look at this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. That's describing, this is Uddhava, dear associate of Krishna, who is describing this topic, the contradictions within Krishna, how to reconcile. There's that word again, reconcile. Girls in the front, reconcile. Do you remember the definition I gave? This is a vocabulary exercise. Reconcile. Put it in your notes so you learn a vocabulary word. Reconcile. Over here is this, over here is that. How are they to become the same? Like you're doing you're the bookkeeper for the Hare Krishna temple, or in your home, you have some income and you have a bank book, or you have a checkbook, and at the end of the month you try to make sure the money in and the money out balances with what it says is in the account. That's reconciling, and whoops, they don't balance. So then you find where the mistake is. So then, oh, now they balance. Whew, okay, I've done proper accounting. So, reconciling, over here it says this, and over there it says that. How do you make them say the same thing? How do you reconcile contradictions? This is Uddhava. My Lord, even the learned sages become disturbed in their intelligence when they see that your greatness engages in fruitive work, although you are free from all desires, that you take birth, although you are unborn, that you flee out of fear of the enemy and take shelter in a fort, although you are the controller of invincible time, and that you enjoy householder life, surrounded by many women, although you enjoy yourself, with a capital S. So, Rupa Goswami points to this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam in his writing, Laghu Bhagavatamrita, and makes the following comment. Beautiful. Contradictions seen in the pastimes of the Lord's potencies are as inconceivable opulence. They decorate him. They are not defects. If these things were not true, then the sages' intelligence would not be bewildered. Got it? If they were not true, it's real easy. Just not true. End of confusion. But when they're true, then those who are merely using their intellect acumen, they're bewildered. Although they're true. That is not so. The Lord's inconceivable potency is the cause of these pastimes. Whatever he wishes, it manifests. So, those of you that were with us last Thanksgiving holiday, the part one of Brahma Samhita that we discussed that time, maybe you can remember this term, Ichha Shakti. Ichha means desire. Like in Bhagavad Gita, Ichha Dvesa Samutena Dvandva Mohena Bharata. By desire and hate. Ichha. So when Krishna has desire, he didn't have to lift a pinky. He doesn't have to lift Govardhan Hill with the little finger of his left hand. He does that as a leela. We can't do that. We can't lift a mountain. We can't lift a mountain with the little finger of our left hand or anything. And we can't do it simply on desire either. Krishna can. Because he has unlimited potencies. And when that Ichha Shakti, that potency of desiring happens, the sub-potencies serving that potency, they zoom, zoom, they go off and do the thing. He didn't have to say, you know, let Govardhan Hill be lifted. It's lifted. Or let there be creation, like it says in the Old Testament of the Bible. God said, let there be light, and there was. And it was good. Didn't he have to say it? He just has a desire. And his inconceivable, Bhaktisiddhanta says, unthinkable, unlimited, his potency is unlimited. The problem in understanding that is we think he's limited, or we can't do that, so he can't do that. I'm limited, so how can he be more than me? We have to be equal, or I'm better. But if he's more than me, no problem. He just desires, and it manifests by the agency of his inconceivable potency. Again, here's a summary statement by Bhaktisiddhanta. The sum and substance of it is that though he possesses diverse and apparently mutually contradictory qualities, still they are in a universal harmonious concordance. He has great vocabulary. Universal harmonious concordance. Everything becomes reconciled. It's like a symphony that's perfectly orchestrated, so it sounds, although there's the bass, boom, 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 and there's the piccolo, and all the other sounds of the orchestra that put them all together into this universal harmonious concordance. Ta-da! That's Krishna. And then he has, right after that sentence comes this sentence. This is what is meant by chid dharma, or chit. Because the next word begins with a D, dharma, becomes chit. But chit. And what's chit? As in sat chit ananda. It's fully cognizant. Dharma. Or dharma in the sense of the nature of Krishna. Krishna's nature is that he's fully cognizant. Whatever he does and whatever he is, it's in full consciousness. It's not, there's no limitation, nor shortcoming, no unwholesomeness, no limitation. Distinct from that which is material, has all of those lesser qualities. And there's a note. Knowing what's coming up, of course, Bhaktisiddhanta knows, but having studied Brahma Samhita, I also know, we're going to hear this same type of language help us understand his pastimes in text 37. And parakīya rasa means the relationship that Krishna has with unmarried gopis or the wives of others. That's immoral in worldly affairs. So it's celebrated when Krishna does those things. And how do we reconcile the unreconcilable? So we need to understand these points to further explain those other points. So we will get to text 37, but you're going to have to remember text 33 when we discuss text 37. With the eyes of devotion, one can see. So that's... we'll go through it again, quickly. This is Bhaktisiddhanta's language for each of these terms. Advaitam. Although there's the Brahman feature and the Paramatma feature, Krishna is undivided. He remains one divisible supreme. Indivisible supreme. So there are these features. The Brahman features compared to the sunshine. And sunshine comes from the sun globe. So there's the sunshine, there's the sun disk, and there's the sun god. The person from whom the sun disk and the sunshine come. And this is the comparative realizations of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan for those of you that are familiar with these terms. These three features, Bhagavan, Paramatma, and Brahman, this is the verse that's in being referenced. Those who are perfect seers of the absolute truth, the tattva darshis, that's the verse, know well that the above three features of the one absolute truth are different perspective views of the same non-dual entity seen from different angles of vision, yet the Bhagavan feature supreme. This is taken from the purport of that verse. So that's the Advaita. Here's Jiva Goswami in his commentary on this verse. I've taken the liberty to cut and paste and share with you what Jiva Goswami says. Advaitam means that Govinda has no equal in the world, just as a king is incomparable to others. Advaitam. No equal. And the reference that he uses is Uddhava, when glorifying Krishna, when speaking to Vidura, he says, Krishna's actions are amazing. They're not to be understood. There's no one to compare Krishna to. He's Advaita. Achyutam, we heard this definition. Living entities come from Krishna. Expansions of him come from Krishna. Yet he remains undivided, achyutam. And Jiva Goswami, in his commentary, writes the following. The all-pervading, indestructible, and supreme in all worlds, that's Govinda, because it's by his mercy that his devotees do not fall. Remember the word? Chuta and achuta. Chuta means that's us, we can fall. But Krishna's mercy is such that His devotees cannot fall. Why not? He protects them. Why does he protect them? Because he's merciful. He extends special mercy to his devotees. And the example that Jiva Goswami gives is this one. Those of you that are children and read Krishna book, do you recognize this painting? What's the painting? Radha? Varuna. He went to the abode of Varuna. Why did he go to the... Why did Krishna go to the abode of Varuna? Save his father? What happened to his father? His father was kidnapped. Really? Krishna's father was kidnapped? Yes. Who kidnapped Krishna? How bold. Who did that? Varuna's assistants. Why did they kidnap his father? Because he was breaking the Ekadasi on the next morning, the Dwadasi, by taking his sacred bath in the Jamuna. And they did their astronomical calculation and said, hey, he's breaking his fast too early. Let's kidnap him. And took him to the abode of Varuna. And when this happened, the others who were with Nanda Maharaj saw Nanda Maharaj disappear in the river Jamuna. They were in great anxiety. So what did they do? Krishna, please help. Krishna said, no problem, I'll go find Dad, Nanda Maharaj. And with Balaram, there you see Krishna and Balaram in the lower left corner, Krishna and Balaram went to the abode of Varuna. And when he came to the abode of Varuna, that's why you see all the fish swimming around, the abode of Varuna, Varuna immediately got up off his throne and started worshipping Krishna. And when Nanda Maharaj saw a Varuna worshipping little Krishna, he thought, wait a minute, what's this? Why, Varuna is a demigod and he's worshipping my son. Who's my son? And so, when they all went back to Vrindavan, Nanda Maharaj called an assembly of elders. And he wanted to share with them what happened. And so they had this, you know, who is Krishna conference. And Krishna thought about the situation. He thought very deeply about the situation. And he then considered that he would show them the spiritual world. That's a nice thing to do when people get bewildered. You show them the spiritual world. So Krishna took Nanda Maharaj and the residents, the elders of Vrindavan, to the same place that later Krishna was going to show the spiritual world to Akura, and he showed the spiritual world to all the residents of Vrindavan. Of course, they're already in the spiritual world. So our acharyas comment, what they saw was the spiritual world minus themselves in the spiritual world, because they would have gotten really bewildered if they saw themselves in the spiritual world. So he didn't do that. He just showed them without themselves, which is the abode, which is achyuta. It's beyond material darkness. Nice. And then anadim means without a beginning, yet he performs a pastime of birth. So he's anadim, he's Mahavishnu, or his expansion is Mahavishnu, from which everything that comes into being comes into being, from Mahavishnu. Then Anantarupam, so his forms are unlimited, or the forms are endless. Although unlimited forms, there's still one entity. A little sharing. This is on this topic. Jiva Goswami discusses in his Bhagavat Sandarbha the following. He quotes a verse from the Upanishads first, Brihat Aranyaka Upanishad, that says, the translation reads, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is blissful and eternal. Although he is the oldest, he is completely free from the infirmities of old age. Although he manifests himself in many different forms, all these forms are actually his single transcendental form. Ananta Rupam is being illustrated by Jiva Goswami by this Upanishad verse. And then there's another verse that he quotes from Katha Upanishad. Although the Supreme Personality of Godhead may appear to be different forms, the forms are actually one single transcendental form. These forms are not at all different from each other. Just like, you know, the universal form. There's so many forms within the universal form because there's so many aspects of the universe. And Krishna showed that universal form to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna is the original Adyam Purana Purusham, yet he exhibits the pastime of birth. Yet he is without a beginning. And he remains Navayovana, always youthful. So now, how to understand these contradictions? Well, we're not going to understand these contradictions by being a scholar. Have as many PhDs as you like, and these things will not be understood. So, he remains eternally youthful, but living entities are not like that. We're influenced by the time energy, and the time energy destroys everything. But Krishna's body is never destroyed, and it doesn't undergo these changes like time that forces living entities to go through the cycles of evolution. Time doesn't act upon Krishna that way. Time acts upon the living entity. But Krishna, he doesn't get old. He's eternally youthful. Bhaktisiddhanta writes, his graceful threefold bending form with flute in hand possessed eternal blooming youth and, in big letters, all unwholesomeness that is to be found in limited time and space. He's beyond all unwholesomeness, just looking at his form. Because, again, his pastimes are going to have that same beyond unwholesomeness feature. You notice I'm saying it. I've said it like 20 times so far. Because it's a big problem amongst people that have a material conception and go to the pastimes of Krishna and start having a problem with Krishna. In the transcendental realm, there is no past and future, but only the unalloyed and immutable present time. Nice language. How could you say this better? In the transcendental realm, there's no past and future, but only the unalloyed and immutable present time. In the transcendental sphere, there is no distinction between the object and its qualities, and no such identity as is found in the limited mundane region. So, like, you know that example, the fire and its capacity to burn. They're not the same. But in the spiritual realm, an object and its qualities are the same. It's a different set of rules. It's the realm of the absolutes. Now, one might think, well, maybe I could go study the Vedas and get the answer to all these things. But Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atmabhaktau. So the study of the Vedas alone, Durlabham, very difficult. As in, not possible. And Adurlabham is very easy by devotion. So now, within the purport of this text, there's a question raised. Excuse me, the next text. Yeah, within the purport of the next text. If the potency of cognitive function does not extend to the realization of the transcendental, what else can? In other words, if we cannot use our jnana function, our speculative function, to enter into transcendence, what else can? You with me? Okay. Here's the answer from this purport of this verse. The jiva soul attains the nearest approach to the absolute identity, that's the previous verse actually, only when the spiritual force of ecstatic energy appears in him by the grace of Krishna. Remember that one? The picture of Bhakti Siddhanta and his statement. We can come closest possible to being like Krishna if we're imbued with or we're invested with Krishna's ecstatic energy, Ladini Shakti. Discrimination power alone is not enough. So here comes a real long set of text. You're not supposed to do this with PowerPoints, but I did it anyways because it was the best way to convey it. Why one cannot understand Krishna merely through study of the Vedas? And Bhaktisiddhanta's teaching is that the Vedas, which are not touched by bhakti, cannot help us. For example, the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas is not going to disclose Krishna. It can disclose other truths, like how to have long health, or long life, and how to have good health, and how to become wealthy, and you know how to get things of this world. It's effective, but it doesn't teach us how to reach Krishna or how to understand Krishna. And as this little note says, there's some scriptural references that will support this statement by Bhaktisiddhanta. However, there is a portion of the Vedas that does thoroughly invest bhakti within it, and then one can understand Krishna that way. The Vedas touched by bhakti provide the beginning of confidential knowledge, which will help increase our faith and devotion. So we're encouraged to read those texts, and our acharyas teach those texts in disciplic succession, because that's going to get us to the conclusion. That is, the purpose of the Vedas is to know Krishna. He says it in Bhagavad Gita. Yes? Vedaish Dasayavar Aham Eva Vedyo. The purpose of the Vedas is to know me. So there's some portion of the Vedas that aren't going to directly help you know Krishna. It's going to help you get closer to the point where you can enter into the realm of bhakti. It's like the example of making wet wood into dry wood before you put the dry wood onto the fire. And helping those in the lower modes of nature come to the mode of goodness so they can then enter into devotional service. But some never enter into the realm of devotional service just by doing the Karma Kanda rituals. Here's from Bhaktisiddhanta's purport. This is a little different than what we're used to hearing. So you have to pay special attention, put your antennas up. The Vedas originate in sound. And sound originates in the mundane ether. So the Vedas cannot present before us a direct view of the transcendental world, or Goloka. It is only when the Vedas are imbued with the chit potency that they are enabled to deal with the transcendental. But Goloka reveals itself to every jiva soul when he is under the influence of these two, the spiritual cognitive potency joined to the ecstatic, to the essence of ecstatic energy. The ecstatic function of devotion is boundless and is surcharged with unalloyed transcendental knowledge. So let's go back and try to understand what Bhaktisiddhanta is teaching. At least I'm accustomed to, probably all of us, because we hear from the same source, the Vedas originate in Narayana. Has anyone heard something different? The Vedas are emanations from the breathing of Narayana. And because they come from Narayana, they're not fallible, they're not to be questioned. So, since they're coming from Narayana, they should all be transcendental, it would seem. But here's the but. But everything comes from Narayana. You know, the mundane world comes from Narayana. And it's not in and of itself transcendental, although it's from Narayana. Similarly, the Vedas come directly from Narayana. But many of the Vedas, they're not imbued with this chit potency. Rather, they're purposeful. It's like the desire tree that helps us get material things, dharma, artha, kama. And that's not transcendental, dharma, artha, kama. It's religious, it's dharmic, but it's not transcendental. It'll take you to the heavenly realm, but it won't take you to the kingdom of God. In the eternal service of Krishna. It won't take you there. Do it perfectly. It won't take you there. It's not intended to take you there. It's intended to get you to the mode of goodness and then, very important, through the association of one who's carrying bhakti, then you become bhakti-ized or ignited in devotion. And through devotion you can go to the kingdom of God. So therefore there's a portion of the Vedas that don't just deal with dharma, artha, kama, nor do they just deal with moksha. They deal with goloka. Not just how to get to the Brahma Jyoti and become one. It's how to enter into your eternal pastimes of love with Krishna. That's bhakti. So bhakti is these two. Joined, the cognitive potency, chit, and Ladini Shakti, or the ecstatic energy. So there's something about the ecstatic energy that's ecstatic. It makes one feel like kirtan. It makes one peaceful and then jubilant. And it's nice as a traveling sannyasi to see this practically everywhere I go. Little children, as soon as kirtan starts, they start dancing. I mean, certain ones dance more than others, but they're clapping and they're dancing, and it's not just the rhythm, it's the ecstatic potency is acting on the soul. How fortunate is that soul to receive at an early age the ecstatic potency so directly? And for us, we're not little children, we're hearing these topics of Krishna like this, and it's invested with the ecstatic potency. Yes. And the cognitive potency. And so bhakti awakens. It's stimulating. Like I said, may you all become, you know, enlivened in your natural ecstatic love for Krishna just through hearing these things. It's wonderful. And it doesn't matter whether you're the audience hearing it or you're the speaker speaking it. It's the sound vibration. The understanding imparted by the devotional scriptures, they act like a catalyst for our devotion. So the adults, you know what a catalyst is, but our children, you know what catalyst is? Okay. We have a science student that's eager to share what he knows, but let me just say what catalyst is. It's something that when you add a catalyst to, let's say, you have a, in your science classroom, you have a beaker, you have a jar, a glass jar, that has a bunch of liquid in it and some other stuff mixed with the liquid. You put a catalyst in, and all this reactive thing starts to happen because it the catalyst doesn't change, it just allows the conditions present to transform into whatever the next thing is. Catalyst. So, similarly, what we're doing right now, hearing Brahma Samhita, or when you attend Srimad Bhagavatam class, or you read Srimad Bhagavatam in your home, that's the catalyst that does what? It takes the heart and transforms the heart, because there's dormant devotion within the heart. It awakens that dormant devotion within the heart. It stimulates ecstatic love because it's the ecstatic potency. Bhaktisiddhanta, in his commentary, is explaining this Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atma Bhaktam. Here's Srila Prabhupada's comment on the same subject from Chaitanya Charitamrita. When the samvit factor of cognition is enlightened by the ladini potency of the same internal energy, they work together. And only thus one can attain knowledge of the personality of Godhead. Is it clear? This is, you know, to help us understand the Vedeshu Durlabham. Just by studying the Vedas alone, transcendence is not going to be yours. But when devotion awakens through these devotional scriptures, then it becomes possible. So now we're just about to end. Here's some scriptural references that speak the same. This is from the 10th canto Bhagavatam, the first one. The Shrutis. What's the Shrutis? Shrutis is the original four Vedas. Shrutis. Samaveda, Yajurveda, Atharva Veda, Rig Veda. That's the Shrutis. The Shrutis have become exhausted by continually searching for the lotus feet of Mukunda. And they are still searching to this very day for those lotus feet for which the gopis have already attained. Good one, huh? Here's another. This is Lord Brahma speaking in the 10th canto Bhagavatam. Their entire life and soul is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mukunda, the dust of whose lotus feet is still being searched for in the Vedic mantras. Krishna is speaking of the residents of Vrindavan. They're so exalted. They've attained Krishna's lotus feet, for which the Vedic mantras are still searching. Then, here's a quote from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. This is a book by Sanatana Goswami, a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. And this is taken from a section where there's an intense debate between personified Vedas. Some of the personified Vedas are agamas. The agama section of the Vedas is the rituals for Karmakanda. The agamas describe those rituals. So the agamas were on one side, and then there's some other Shrutis and Puranas on the other side, and they're having this fierce debate about whether or not liberation is achieved merely by chanting mantras that worship the personality of Godhead. Then there was some others, the bhakti, the portions of the Vedas that are imbued with bhakti. They couldn't take it. They covered their ears and they left. What a waste of time going through this argument and debate procedure to understand. Tarka apratishta. You can't understand things by argument and logic. The absolute truth is not understood that way. He discloses himself to his devotee. So what's needed is devotion. And then you can know and you can understand. There's a nice example, and this is now our children can pay special attention. This is a story that Prabhupada narrated in this regard. In fact, it's an illustrated children's book that took the story. And it's a story of Narada Muni going to visit Narayana in Vaikuntha. One time, Narada Muni, on his way to visit Vaikuntha, Lord Narayana, as he was approaching Narayana's abode, he saw by the river one Brahmana. And the Brahmana said, "Oh, Narada Muni, how wonderful to see you. Where might you be going today?" "Oh, I'm going to see Lord Narayana in Vaikuntha." "Wonderful. Could you ask him a question on my behalf? Could you ask him, when will I be going to the spiritual world?" So Narada said, "Sure. I'll ask Lord Narayana that question." And later, Narada Muni encountered another person, a cobbler. Simple man, simple profession. The cobbler was saying, "Oh, Narada Muni, how wonderful your association coming to see a lowly personality like me. My life is filled with special fortune today. Please tell me, where are you going?" "I'm going to see Lord Narayana in Vaikuntha." "Could you ask him on my behalf, when will I return to him in the spiritual world?" "Sure, I'll ask him that question on your behalf." So Narada Muni went on his way to Vaikuntha because he had a special pass, a pure devotion pass. He could go wherever he wants. And as he came before the personality of Godhead, Narayana, in Vaikuntha, this is his assembly hall in Vaikuntha, apparently, Lord Narayana was very happy to see his pure devotee, Narada Muni, paying him a visit. And in the course of their exchange, Narada Muni, obliging the Brahmana and the cobbler, he asked the question, "When will these two be coming back to Godhead?" And Lord Narayana said, "Well, that Brahmana, he's so puffed up. Even I'm the personality of Godhead. I don't know how many lifetimes it will be for him to come back. But that cobbler, he's very simple and pure in his heart. You can tell him that he'll be returning back to Godhead at the end of this very lifetime." So Narada said, "Very well, I'll convey your reply." And then Narayana said, "If you just to see why it is like that, then you can please just ask them or state, when you saw me, what I was doing. And you can tell them that Narayana had a needle, and he, through the open end of the needle, he was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle. And see what their response is, and then you'll understand why I said what I said. So, when Narada Muni came to visit the Brahmana, oh, how fortunate you went to see Lord Narayana. Did you remember to ask him that question? He said, yes. He said, well, he finds you so puffed up, he doesn't know how many lifetimes it will be before you come back to Godhead. How insulting. I don't believe you went to Narayana. Narayana would not say something like that. I'm pure Brahman. Tell me, what was Narayana doing when you saw him? Well, Narayana was passing an elephant through an eye of a needle. Oh, I don't believe you. You never went to Narayana. You're just making things up. And then when Narada Muni came before the cobbler, he told the cobbler, Narayana said, at the end of this very lifetime, you'll be going back to Godhead. And the cobbler said, oh, my Lord Narayana, he's so merciful, he's so wonderful. And by the way, my dear cobbler, when I saw Narayana, you know what he was doing? He was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle. And the cobbler said, how wonderful my Supreme Lord is. He's full of transcendental potency. And Narada was a little surprised at this uneducated Brahmana's response, and he said, can you tell me how it is that you so easily can accept that he was passing an elephant through the eye of a needle? Doesn't that seem inconceivable to you? And the cobbler was standing near a banyan tree, and on the ground there were many banyan seeds. So he picked up one of the banyan pods. Inside the pod, there's many seeds. And he said, see this banyan pod. Inside this banyan pod, there's many, many banyan seeds. And each one of those seeds represents a banyan tree. And each one of those banyan trees, when fully grown, is bigger than many elephants. So if my Supreme Lord Narayana, he can put many, many banyan trees inside this little pod. What difficulty is it for him to pass an elephant through the eye of a needle? Then Narada Muni could understand why it was that the cobbler was very soon going to go back to Godhead, because he had devotion. While the Brahmana had knowledge of the Vedas, Vedeshu Durlabham, Adurlabham Atma Bhaktau. So, very nice lesson. Just as with this banyan pod, which in which there's banyan seeds, how that all happens, the inconceivable potency of Krishna. Let some scientist make a banyan pod. Just one of them. I remember one lecture Prabhupada was saying, let the scientists make one mosquito. He's a little insect, and flies around, and he can fly up and down in any direction, and not only that, the mosquito can make another mosquito. Let them make one mosquito. That they cannot do. Let them make one banyan pod. Let them manifest the inconceivable potencies that the Supreme Lord has. And then that which is otherwise inconceivable becomes conceivable. Because then when one understands or recognizes, the Supreme Lord has unlimited inconceivable potencies. Here's Jiva Goswami's Bhagavat Sandarbha expressing the same. these apparently contradictory qualities of the Lord may be accepted because he is the reservoir of hundreds of mutually contradictory potencies, and therefore any otherwise impossible thing may easily be done by him. Is it clear? He means one who possesses unlimited numbers of inconceivable potencies. And those inconceivable potencies do these contradictory things because he has them. They're within him. They are him. They're his. We don't have those. We're not Govinda. We're not Krishna. But he is. Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. So that's verse 33. And tomorrow morning, 34 and 35, we'll conclude that little section. Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions? Yeah. Here's one that works. You want one that works?
How is the adhya different than the anadi?
How is the word adhya different from anadi?
They're similar. Adhya means original. And anadi means one who has no origin, specifically. Okay? Similar. But not the same. Yes.
What does unwholesomeness mean?
Say it again.
What does unwholesomeness mean?
Uh-huh. We had a little session on wholesome, unwholesome. Someone was asking me for some examples. But we'll do some more. That's because it's an important term. You know, there's this big store called Whole Foods. Right? You've heard of that place. And there they promote our foods are wholesome. And unwholesome is foods that have preservatives and pesticides and, you know, harmful stuff for your health. It's unwholesome. But they claim our food is wholesome. So, like, that's an example of, in our contemporary life, of using wholesome, unwholesome. So now, with the distinction between forms, like, you know, we have a body. So our body gets diseases. Ever get sick? Sometimes. So, that's, Krishna doesn't get sick. There's no unwholesomeness in the form of Krishna. Krishna doesn't get old, although he's the oldest. He's eternally youthful. He doesn't have that unwholesomeness of old age. His body doesn't die. That's kind of unwholesome. Really too bad, unwholesome. Or, like I mentioned, make mistakes. You ever make a mistake? Well, some years ago, maybe you made some mistake. So I had a science teacher who said, yeah, I remember, you know, in 1978 I made a mistake. So, but Krishna doesn't have that unwholesomeness. Every conditioned soul, there's four defects. Those are unwholesomenesses. You know what the four defects are? Subject to illusion, make mistakes.
Cheating.
Huh? Cheating propensity. That's unwholesome. But Krishna doesn't have that. So, now, applied, Krishna runs from the battlefield. You know that? Ranchor. You've heard that name before? Ranchor? When Kaliyavana came to attack Krishna, Krishna could destroy him, no problem. But Krishna ran. And Kaliyavana is running after Krishna. Come back, you coward. You're afraid of me. Krishna's looking over his shoulder, just out of reach of Krishna, or just out of reach of Kaliyavana. So Kaliyavana tried running faster, and Krishna ran faster, just a little bit, so Kaliyavana couldn't reach him. That's unwholesome, apparently. But it was a pastime. Krishna led Kaliyavana into a cave where Muchukunda was. Muchukunda kicked Muchukunda. Get up, you coward! And Muchukunda turned, and from his eyes came fire, and Kaliyavana burned to ashes. So it wasn't out of fear he was running from Kaliyavana. But it looked like, because that's an unwholesome, a cowardice on the part of a Kshatriya. That's unwholesome. You get the idea? Something that's like impure or a weakness or a defect. Unwholesome. And in Krishna, there's no unwholesomeness. And that which is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss, it's absolute. There's no unwholesomeness. Something else? Yes? Our children are 3 for 3 this morning, or this evening.
Krishna Maharaj, in this one slide where you mentioned, like, the Vedas are, oh, there's like quotes where the Vedas are still searching for the lotus feet of Mukunda, but the gopis have found it. Found the lotus feet.
Yes, I remember that one.
Yeah, so in two verses there was the use of Mukunda.
Yeah.
Is there any significance to that, or is that just like a coincidence? I mean, like.
What's the punchline of your question? Not the whole background.
Yeah. So, like, in both those verses, it mentioned, like, the lotus feet of Mukunda.
Yeah.
So is there any significance to, like...
Why?
Yeah.
Why using that term?
Yeah, why using
that term? Okay, sure. You've read Bhagavad Gita. And in the early chapter, the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna addresses Krishna in a number of different ways. Rishikesh, and so on. So each name invokes a certain aspect of or feature of Krishna. Mukunda addresses he who is the giver of liberation. So that's the significance. That portion of the Vedas that's not invested with the ecstatic potency or the Ladini Shakti cannot give liberation. So they're searching for Mukunda, but they're not finding. Okay. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I understand chit means cognition. And there are two words, chit dharma and chit potency that were mentioned. Chit dharma you mentioned about its transcendental nature. That's, I think, Jiva Goswami defined that.
This is a college question, I can tell.
And the chit potency you mentioned was the spiritual cognitive potency. I'm just trying to understand, like, the connection between cognition as sat-chit ananda and chit dharma and chit potency. Like,
well, dharma, the way that Bhaktisiddhanta was using the term, is not religiosity, but the essence of one's being, as in, you know, Sanatana Dharma. The constitutional position of the living being. The constitutional position of the living being that's invested with or empowered by the cognitive potency is distinct from the unwholesomeness or the limitations of matter. When your consciousness becomes Krishna conscious, then the activity, the essence of the living entity is restored, unlike the unwholesomeness or limitedness of the material position, the conditioned position.
So that's when we're able to reconcile the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Anyone else? Okay.
My question is on the verse in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, where Krishna mentions Param Bhavam, Ajananto.
Yes.
So we were talking about Ananta Rupam in this verse. Is that the same understanding of Param Bhavam?
Not exactly. Param Bhavam is a broader term. His higher nature is how it's translated. Param Bhavam, Bhava, his state of mind or his being. Param Bhavam. They don't know my higher nature, which is changeless and supreme. So it's close, but it's not the same. This Param Bhavam is more of a broad general term. These others are a little more specific. So related but not the same. We have some online questions? Okay. Okay, there's one over here too.
Hi, Krishna Guru Maharaj.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Samvit and Haladini Shakti when it is invested in Jiva.
Well, I just repeated Bhakti Siddhanta, but yeah, go ahead.
So, my question is, does this mercy invested in the Jiva in certain stages of the Bhakti or it is independently?
Ask it again, please.
The Samvit and Haladini Shakti.
Yeah.
Showering the mercy on Jiva.
It's Krishna does that, not the Jivas go out and get some.
Yeah, Krishna does that on Jiva at a certain stage of purification of bhakti process.
It's gradual.
It's gradual.
It's not zero and then 100. It's gradual. Like the rising of the sun is gradual. So similarly, gradual. Right now, we're being... By participating in what we're doing right now, we're receiving both. It's not 100. It's not a zero. It's somewhere in between. And for different persons, the experience will be different also. Same subject matter, same place, same time. Okay? Gradual. Go ahead. Just speak, then you can monitor the volume.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So my question is related to what Prabhuji asked. Like, from your presentation, I'm understanding that it's important to receive Radharani's grace, the Haladini Shakti.
Yes.
So, as he asked, like, how can one become a proper recipient of that mercy? Because that seems to be absolutely essential.
Yes. Well, what does Rupa Goswami say? Eligibility of a candidate for devotional services were the answer to that question. The question is answered by sincerity, that you really want. And then Krishna will test our sincerity. Are you sure you really want? I'm paraphrasing Prabhupada's teaching. Are you sure you want Krishna? What if there's a little trouble? You really want Krishna or you want relief from your trouble? And you say, no, Krishna, I really want you. Let the troubles come. I just want you. Because you will carry me beyond those troubles. Oh, they're really sincere. What if there's a little sense gratification? A little. On the side, little sense gratification. Are you sure you want me? No, I don't want that sense gratification. I want you. Oh, they're very sincere. Then I'll give myself to them because they really want me. So that's the qualification. That's the sincerity. And Rupa Goswami takes it further and says that intent, that sincerity, eagerness, can be called by the term lolium, or greediness for that, like intense longing for that relationship with Krishna. Loving relationship with Krishna. Serving Krishna. Nothing but Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. That's, you know, so that's the eligibility for devotional service. And then, like this other question, there's degrees of it. Well, a little bit. So Krishna smiles and says, okay, a little bit. I think I want more than a little bit. Are you sure? Like that. He's not like, it's not like a disciplinarian kind of, you know, he'll help us. We'll hear in verse 55 about how mixed goes to unmixed. In from desiring material to the position of desiring only spiritual, there's a transition, and it's discussed in verse 55. Very nice verse. Yes?
My question is on the previous verse where the translation says that each of the limbs, and I'll just summarize, maintains and manifests the infinite universes, both spiritual and mundane. That's the last few words.
I'm familiar. So what's your question?
The question is, Maharaj, my limited understanding was that the mundane universes are infinite, but spiritual universe is one. So maybe I missed something. You made a point in the morning about it, but could you please correct my understanding here?
But the spiritual is one?
There is one spiritual universe.
No.
Infinite mundane universes.
And the spiritual realm is infinitely more than the material realm, which is infinite. What's that? It's beyond our comprehension. It's language is to help us get a sense of something that's beyond our conception. So what's, the numbers of universes are finite, but so many you cannot count them. That's how many. And the spiritual universes are literally infinite. But it's not, don't think of the spiritual realm as like the material realm. It's the other way around. This is finite, and that's not. So, in one sense, you can say, one infinite spiritual realm, which is maybe what you're saying. But that one infinite spiritual realm is infinite. So infinite, there's other languages, infinite spiritual universes.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Maharaj, from our morning discussion, I was thinking one thing that we discussed. Krishna has 64 qualities, and four of them, the 60 qualities Vishnu have, but only four of them which only Krishna possesses.
Correct.
And one of them says that he performs wonderful variety of pastime and he is surrounded by devotees. So I was thinking in Vishnu Loka also,
sure,
there must be other devotees,
yeah,
who are serving the Lord. So
there
Lord
are.
Lord is there and there are pastimes.
Yeah.
So, and we say that Vishnu has only 60 qualities and not those.
I understand your question. The goddess of fortune is the eternal consort of Narayana. Lakshmi is the eternal consort of Narayana. And they're both in Vaikuntha. So along with many other loving associates, Lakshmi is there also. Lakshmi hears about Krishna's pastimes of rasa dance with the gopis. So Lakshmi desires that which is inconceivable, dancing with Lord Narayan, with many Lakshmis in Vaikuntha? No. So she goes to the place where Krishna is performing pastimes. And she cannot enter. So she undergoes austerities. And she still cannot enter. So why is that? And the answer is, she is still thinking of herself as the husband, or the wife of the goddess of fortune. Excuse me, the wife of Narayana. I'm the goddess of fortune. She's thinking in ways that the intimacy of love of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan are eclipsed by this one quality that you're reading of the four. It's not only that there's loving associates, but the quality of the love of those associates in Goloka, the intimacy of their love is profound. So much so they completely forget that Krishna is the fully opulent Supreme Lord. Their love is so intense and intimate. It eclipses his opulence. That kind of love. That's the fourth, or one of the four. And the love in Vaikuntha is certainly pure. There's no material tinge. But there's a different quality of that love in Vrindavan or in Goloka. That's one of the uniquenesses that Narayana does not have. Although Narayana is his expansion. Is that to answer your question? Yes.
So Maharaj, the same follow-up question on that one.
Okay, we're on a roll here.
Yeah. So can we, because I heard that it is not that Lord Narayana doesn't have the 64 qualities, but he doesn't exhibit that four qualities because of... If that is not the case, then how can we say that it is also said that the emanations from Lord Krishna are also complete and infinite, right? Possessing all the qualities of Krishna, then how would that statement be true?
I'm trying to recall how our acharyas have answered this. They use, I can't think of the exact example they use. It's some kind of a metaphor where I can't recall. The potencies of Narayana are the same as the potencies of Krishna. So the potencies are the same, just like a candle lights another candle. The next candle is of the same potency as the candle from which it was lit. So the potencies are the same, but the qualities are not the same. I mean, Narayana, one of the qualities, for example, is flute playing. So do you mean to say that he has the same quality as Krishna? He just doesn't pull his flute out of his pocket or something. Huh?
That's what my
understanding was. The potencies are there, but there's an aspect of Govinda that as he expands, I mean not directly, but as he expands Narayana, all the potencies are there, but these four qualities are exclusively within Govinda and not within Narayana. That's my understanding. But I'm trying to remember how our acharyas explained this, and it's by some metaphor, it makes it really simple, and I can't remember it. So, but again, as one candle lights another candle, the potency, the same illumination power is there in the second candle as the original. So potency-wise, they're the same. But there's qualities within Govinda that are not similarly transferred and transmitted, simply not exhibited by Narayan because, like, whatever the reason, he doesn't exhibit them. I don't know where that idea comes from. It's not necessary that Krishna expands himself, that everything that's of him becomes manifest within his expansions. Like, you know, for example, the living entities are his expansions. The Vivinamsa expansions. They're very tiny. They don't have all of the 60. You know, Krishna can mete out or measure out as he wishes. So he has 64 qualities, and 60 of them are passed on to Narayana. And look at what those 60 are. The last five. The 60 that Narayana has, or Vishnu has, that Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma don't have. Look at the ones that Lord... So look at the examples and you can see. These are unique in Krishna, in Govinda alone. Anyone else? We're done. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.